Johnny O'Connor bought an automobile. He took his sweetheart for a ride one Sunday. Johnny was togged up in his best Sunday clothes. She nestled close to his side. Things went just dandy till he got down the road. Then something happened to the old machinery. That engine got his goat, off went his hat and coat. Everything needed repairs. He'd have to get under, get out and get under, to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen. But every minute, when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. A dozen times they'd start to hug and kiss, and then the darned old engine, it would miss. And then he'd have to get under, get out and get under, and fix up his automobile. Millionaire Wilson said to Johnny one day, your little sweetheart don't appreciate you. I have a daughter who is hungry for love. She likes to ride every day. Johnny had visions of a million in gold. He took her riding in his little auto. But every time that he went to say, marry me, 'twas the old story again. He'd have to get under, get out and get under, to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen. But every minute, when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. Every time that he would reach for a kiss, it seems a darned old spark plug, it would miss. And then he'd have to get under, get out and get under, and fix up his automobile. He'd have to get under, get out and get under, to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen. But every minute, when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. It seems that once she sat down on his knee, and then he lost control, ran right up a tree. And then he had to get under, get out and get under, and fix up his automobile.
Good evening. Bernie Golias here, and this is the Auto Era, and you're listening to WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College, and Community Radio. Welcome, everybody. You probably noticed that there were some delays here initially, but I'm the guy that turned the radio station on tonight, so that's always fun to do that. But anyway, last week I wasn't here. I was in Tucson, Arizona, and went to the Antique Automobile Club of America Grand National and National Meet. It was fantastic. If you've never been to any of the AACA meets, you're missing something. And if you're not in the club, you're missing something. So anyway, it was great. We had the beautiful weather. It was 85 degrees and sunny. And it was like almost a concours d'elegance when it on the Grand National on Friday. Had about 56 very special, unique cars. They were the creme de la creme. And on Friday, we had a car show as well, a meet, national meet. And those cars are very special. They're always very special. So you may see that up on the, go to AACA.org, AACA.org, and you can probably check that out, and some of the photos, and then the YouTube, and, get familiar with it. But anyway, the Auto Era, what we do here is talk about local history, automotive history overall, and, Cleveland and Northern Ohio's automotive roots were very special, and I always make note of that for our audience. Over 80 automobiles were built within the city limits of Cleveland alone, 115 in North East Ohio, and about 540 automobiles were built in the state of Ohio. So we have a very rich history. And we, you know, we want to talk about all these various cars and, you know, the people that built them, the industrialists of the time, and also some the local history, some people that could talk about, well, you know, we talk about everything here. We talked about Oberlin and the history of the area in the past. George Strum was on as a guest, and we talked about that and how some of the areas were founded. And, you know, all the unique items that people take for granted now that are on cars, like brakes and steering wheels and, you know, all that good stuff. You know, you could use it once in a while. But tonight we have a guest, Tim Simonson. And he's a Model T, Model A guy. He's out in Wellington, I believe it is. And he's here. And I'm going to. So, anyway, I'm introducing Tim Simonson to you now. And we're just going to talk about just about anything. And he's bringing a wealth of history because, like I say, he's very well versed with those cars. And if you want to call in and ask any questions or share any, you know, anything of interest, the phone number here is 440-775-8139. So, welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you, Bernie.
So, tell us a little bit about yourself, what's interesting, and what you can do that's fantastic.
I don't know what I can do that's fantastic, but I'm a local clockmaker, and I do use a Model T occasionally for my clock calls, and have had a little experience with Model Ts. My first one was made out of pieces, parts from Huntington and Wellington and Pittsfield and Penfield townships. And by the time I was 14 years old, I had a chassis together and would practice running, driving the car back on the hill. Build a body for it when I was in high school that kind of simulates a 1909 touring body. And I was the first kid in my class to have a car. You know, it was a Model T. It was popular for at least 3 months with the girls until somebody had gotten a Chevette, and then that kind of shot the whole thing down right there.
Did it have yellow wheels?
No, the wheels were natural.
Okay, I say that because I remember some old timers, and this goes way back, I mean, probably 40 years ago, and, you know, they always used to say, they used to, you know, that, you know, you were mentioning that you had an old car, and, you know, the girls would more or less flock to the cars that had the yellow wheels, you know.
Oh, yeah. But I used to get drive about 14 kids I could load up in that touring car, and I was in high school band, so it was my job to get about, we only had about 30 people in the band, and I could get almost half of them in my car, and I loaded them up one Friday night. We're heading for a football game, and I had a flat, and it was no wonder because the newest tire on that car was 40 years old, and I made us late for pregame, and I remember my band director giving me instructions that I wasn't to do that anymore until I got some new tires for that thing.
And that was a Model T, right?
Oh, yeah.
And what was the year again, one more time?
1913, and that's what I had parts enough to assemble it into.
And a 13 touring car, what top speed would be about what?
Oh, you're doing... I know people say, gosh, my Model T would do 50. Well, not a standard Model T, unless you were going downhill with the wind at your back and a sail up. Generally, you're doing about 30, 35 at the best.
Well, tell us a little bit about a Model T. I mean, that's a four-cylinder, you know, what is it, horsepower rating on that?
And you got 22 horsepower and maybe about 30 miles to a gallon of gas.
And well, that's very good. That's... 26 now is what to say. That's a standard, isn't it? You have to have at least 26 on new cars. It's probably more than that now.
Yeah, well, what you gain in mileage, you kind of lose in speed. And, of course, the gas tank's underneath the driver's seat. Wouldn't Nader love that one?
And then not about 98% of everybody smoked back then, too.
Oh, God, Lord, yes. And you get to a pretty good hill. You see, it's gravity feed for the carburetor. And so if you get to a sizable hill and you don't have the tank full, you can get about partway up it before you stall. And then you back downhill, and then you back, turn the car around, back uphill. They go uphill a lot faster than they do in reverse than they do in low gear.
Now, keep that in mind, everybody, if you ever have a problem stalling out going up a hill. Yeah, I don't think you will, though, not in a new car.
Well, so if the bands get a little worn in the high-low gear, that can present a little problem, too. And sometimes that also necessitates going uphill in reverse. I did that over in Strongsville once on that Strongsville Hill coming out of coming south out of Strongsville on 42. And gas was a little low, and I backed it around at a motel there. And a buddy and I had backed up that hill, and at the top of the hill was a state patrolman who looked at us kind of strange. And I explained the situation to him, and he said it was too ridiculous not to be true and let us go.
There you go. Well, you got Model A's too, right? Aren't you a Model A guy?
Well, I have a 29 Model A I've had for a number of years.
What body style?
Two-door sedan.
Oh, very good. I'll tell you a story about my two-door sedan, but you go right ahead first.
Oh, I bought that in 1972 because I thought the Model T was just a little too cold to drive in the winter, and I bought the Model A, and I'll tell you, the difference between the two was just incredible. All of a sudden, I had a gasoline heater, an enclosed car, and a standard transmission. It was really living.
Well, now, do you restore your own cars? I mean, you had these cars for 40-some years, right?
Well, actually, I've had the Model T for 50 years this year and the Model A for about 45 years.
Hmm. Well, I got you beat because when you say you got your Model T when you were 14,
mm-hmm.
I got my Model A when I was 13. and that goes back. I was always interested in old cars, but I'm going to tell you my life story, but I think I did that in the first show. But since I was 9 years old, I liked them. And, of course, by the time I was 13, I was, you know, always pestering my parents. I wanted to get an old car, you know. And those mid to late 60s, they were, you know, you can still go down, you know, the main drags of Medina and, you know, out in the country and still find Model A's for $100 behind someone's barn.
Oh, yeah.
But getting back, you have a 29 two-door sedan. I had a 31 Model A two-door sedan, and that's what I tinkered with all through high school. And, of course, I don't have it anymore, but that was the first of my experience of actually working on a car. And it was a lot of fun, no doubt about it.
Oh, they're a great car. Model A's a really stout little rascal. It'll start up in the coldest darn weather. That was an experience I had during the blizzard of 76-77. It was cold and it was snowing, and the Model T was out underneath a tarp, and a buddy and I just, for a lark, went out to see if it would run, and by gosh,
it ran.
It ran, and we made passes all over Wellington. Finally, the druggist in town there flagged us over, and a lady that lived out at the end of town needed some medicine, and we took it, and we hauled it out. There was about 15 inches of snow on the ground. We put chains around the rear wheels, and wheel that out, and then we had someone else ask for bread and milk up at the AMP store. So at the end of the day, the only thing that had crossed in the center of Wellington were skinny old Model A tracks going from north to south to east to west.
Well, one thing I want to also tell our audience that obviously in radio you can't see what we're doing or how we're dressed here, but one thing for certain, Tim is dressed to kill. He looks like he came from, he looks like Alexander Winton on the front cover of Famous But Forgotten. That's excellent. He's got a bow tie on, he's got a vest, he's got a gold watch, a chain, and he had a nice driver's cap on. So he dressed like he just got out of his Model T, and I think that's very appropriate. So, down the road we're going to be, I'm putting up a website, and we'll probably get somebody's photos up there one of these days. But, again, I wanted to do just mention to you that you're listening to the Auto Era, station ID time. And this is WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. And I'm Bernie Goliath, your host for the Auto Era. And tonight's guest is Tim Simonson. And he's telling us some stories of his Model T, Model A. And he's a clock expert as well. So basically, let's get back into another couple minutes here. We got another 10 minutes before a major station break here. And tell us a little bit more about some of the history of the area that you live in, maybe some of the automotive history, and some things that you can relate to the audience.
Well, as far as automobile history, Spencer Township, which Spencer is such a little town now, but a company there that was so big at the time and a very early pioneer in the automobile industry was Spencer Axle. Henry Ford, in his early days, the Ford Motor Company was an assembly plant, and he bought parts from different manufacturers, and Spencer Axle was where he purchased his axles for his cars and early Model Ts to boot. And the story goes that Spencer Axle was specifically had to ship their axles in certain types of crates, and they had to be held together with about 8 nails and have a hole drilled in the top and specific part of the crank on both sides, and they never knew what that was for. At one point, they decided to ship the axles in another manner, and Henry Ford set them all back and told them he didn't want them unless they could be crated as he'd specified. And they'd found out what Henry was doing is he's taking the top and the bottom part of the crates, you take the nails out and straighten them, use them for other parts of the car, take the crates themselves, the sides of the crates, and drop them in for the rear floorboards of the Model T.
Yeah, I heard that. He had most of the stuff packaged so he can reuse everything. He was very smart. And, of course, he can command what he wanted from his suppliers, and they'll definitely do it. Otherwise, that was a lot of business that they would lose.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So, Spencer Axle, how long were they in business? When did Ford, decide not to go with them? Did he buy the Spencer Axle? A lot of the larger companies started buying up all these people, utilizing them within their own organization.
Well, as far as I know, Spencer Axle is still in business. And 1968, they made the landing gear on the limb that landed the first men on the moon. So they're quite proud of that.
Well, you have what you need to do now, Tim, is find out who still is with Spencer Axle and remind them that we have a car show coming up in June, put on by the AACA Northern Ohio Chapter and the Western Reserve Historical Society Crawford, called the Cleveland All-Stars. And You know, we are utilizing a lot of this Cleveland, northeast or northern Ohio history. So this company here is still in business. We definitely do that. You know, make a call to them. Tell them, you know, introduce yourself and let them know what's going on, because that might be something they'd be interested in. And I think, you know, for our listening audience to know that these companies still exist and the lineage still exists, you know, like with Winton. The lineage still exists through Detroit Diesel Allison. You know, was prior to that, was way back, was Cleveland Diesel, and before that was Winton Engine. Of course, General Motors, I think, sold them off. But, you know, it's nice to know that some of these companies still exist, because there was thousands of them at the turn of the last century.
Spencer, or kind of coming to Wellington, there was a company there called Sharp Spark. They made spark plugs for a number of years. It was a Cleveland company, but the factory was in Wellington. And you'll see those spark plugs at flea markets and different plates. But they were quite busy for a number of years, and that company evolved into Cleveland Steel and other companies.
So does Wellington have anything out that way?
Oh, good heavens.
Yeah, Spencer, but it is Wellington. Wellington's not that far from Oberlin here, so I mean, it's...
We're very proud of the fact that the Spirit is 76, which was a painting by Archibald Willard, was...
Yes.
All the inspiration for it came from Wellington, and I guess in 1874, Willard was looking out of the window of his studio, which was above the writer's studio, and saw the 4th of July parade forming up, and he made a comic sketch that he called Yankee Doodle. And from that, he made a quick sketch, and it was kind of hidden away, and one of his partners saw it and said, you know, the centennial's coming up, and I'll bet you this would make something, a nice comic picture that maybe we could sell. And Willard started to work on it, and he said the more he worked on it, the less funny it wanted to be, and he started to think of stories that his grandfather, who had been in the Revolutionary War, had told him. And that was the inspiration for the Spirit of 76. And that painting went to Philadelphia and was on display there. And the story is that General Grant specifically asked to see that particular portrait. And while he was there, the Fair Board had invited the artist, and two of the three models went to the exhibition, and President Grant recognized the tall, thin man that played the fife in the picture, and he went up to him and he said, are you the man in that picture? And he straightened right up. Hugh Mosher was his name, from Brighton. He straightened right up and saluted the president and said, yes, sir, Hugh Mosher, sir. And said President Grant laughed a little bit and said, well, Hugh, he says, you know, I only know two tunes. One of them's Yankee Doodle and one of them isn't. Would you mind playing Yankee Doodle for me? Well, Hugh played Yankee Doodle for President Grant, which I think was the big thing in his life. And the painting went on a world tour. And it's considered the most recognizable piece of American art that's ever been done, that people will recognize around the world as being American. Hugh's buried over in Brighton, and if you're ever by the Brighton Cemetery, if you go back behind the flagpole there, you'll see a big monument that has Mosher on it. It doesn't look looks like most late 19th century stones. It's big and it's granite, but if you look on top of it, it looks like somebody laid a fife right on the top of it, and that's Hugh's grave.
Well, a lot of history here, and we're going to get back into some more history. We're going to take a little break here, but you're listening to The Auto Era, and that's Tim Simonson, our guest. My name is Bernie Golias, your host, and this is WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College, and Community Radio. Well, let's put a song on here that is about a Ford. So we're going to get back into talking about some Fords, and if you want to call in, it's the number is 440-775-8139. Welcome back. Bernie Golias here, and this is the Auto Era. And this is WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. And we're talking to Tim Simonson. And that song was about a Model A. It reminds me of, a cat in agony, actually.
Well, you know,
tell us. You know, we were talking about this, the music, and we're gonna play another one. I think after we hear a little bit about the insight of some of these songs, most of these are all on Edison or But let's Tim talk about it, because he's kind of an expert. But after he heard this, and we're talking about these songs, Tim, give us some insight on them.
Well, you know, you got to realize that Edison was deaf. And
and I think, well yeah, listening.
Not totally deaf, but Thomas Edison made it a personal point to approve every record that was put on the Edison label. And he never quite understood why anybody would pay Caruso at that time $1,000 to make a recording when you could get somebody that sounded halfway decent off the street, anyway, sounded halfway decent to Tom, to make a recording, which was kind of a shame, because a lot of very fine artists weren't recorded on Edison cylinders for that simple reason. But
was he was the first with the type of cylinder with the record? We call a record, but this it was a cylinder.
Yeah,
was the first, wasn't he?
No. Graham Bell.
Oh, Graham Bell, yes.
To the punch.
Yes.
With his own invention, and the Graham Bell came up with recording on a wax cylinder, and that beat Edison out. I mean, the only thing Tom could think of to do with the machine was to make it into a dictating machine. And Bell and his associates had figured out that you could sell music. The term canned music was actually labeled by John Philip Sousa. And Sousa wasn't a real big fan of the phonograph. In fact, he was kind of anti-phonograph, and he referred to it as canned music. As it turns out, probably Sousa is immortalized because of the phonograph. But he only made four cylinders for Edison before he gave up recording for that, for Edison. But Edison had the best recording techniques of the time, and probably got the poorest artist he could, because they would work cheap.
Well, we'll play another song. I think Gasoline Gus is another one, but we'll play that another 10 minutes. But tell us more about some of your experiences with the Model T and driving them around, because I think that's something that we want to relate to. It's history for those that are not familiar with these old cars. And this is, you know, a Model T 1913. You know, it's not a 1936 Chrysler or a 1957 Pontiac. I mean, you know, these are truly antique cars, and they were very still, even in those days, experimental, highly experimental with some of the mechanics that they were using. And if you have a question, I just want to say, again, I'm going to mention the phone number, because if you have a question for Tim, please give us a call, 440-775-8139. We have one phone line in here, and sometimes everybody tries to call at the same time, and then it's busy, and they don't call back. But, Tim, tell us a little bit about some of your experiences with your own, with your car.
Well, I took a rather sizable trip in 1971 in a Model T. It was 20 years old, and I had decided to drive to Kansas City, Kansas. And now you got to understand, a 1913 touring car is open air. Mine had no top, no generator, no starter. And I took off on October the 26th, and I got back November the 3rd. When I took off, it was 65 degrees. When I got back, it was 3 above zero. But I'll get into the story here a little bit. My first day, I made 200 miles from Huntington, Ohio, all the way over to Springfield, and spent my first night there. Only had two flat tires and a plug fuel line, so I made pretty good time. I would make on the average of 180 to 200 miles a day. I got to Illinois, to a little town called Pinckneyville, and I was in a long line of traffic. It was a very warm day, and Model Ts have no water pump. Well, you don't have a water pump, an oil pump, or a gas pump, so those are things you don't have to worry about breaking down. But I was sitting there, and Model Ts do not like to sit idle, and it was getting pretty warm, and I looked up ahead, and there was a state patrolman who flagged me up in from this long line. So I got out of the line, I got down to where he was, and he directed me behind a hay wagon that had been decorated. And my thought was, as well, this must be a homecoming or something for somebody. So I crept along behind this wagon, and pretty soon people got on a wagon, and a brass band pulled in behind me, and I found myself in the annual Pinckneyville, Illinois Halloween parade. I got up by the reviewer stand, and the mayor of Pinckneyville handed me the keys to the city and a check for $50 for coming the furthest to be in the parade. Well, I'm still kind of reeling from this, and I get a little ways further, and there's is sitting in the yard watching a parade is Mrs. Whacker. Now, Mrs. Whacker was a lady I didn't expect to be there. She worked at the A&P store and went to the little Methodist church I went to out in Huntington, and unbeknownst to me, her daughter and son-in-law lived in Pinckneyville, Illinois, and she looked up at me and she said, "Tim, what are you doing here?" And I related the story and said all I was doing was minding my own business, and all of a sudden I'm in a parade. Well, she thought that was pretty funny, and when I continued my trip, and when she got home, she gave the story to the Chronicle Telegram, and artist did a little depiction of this, and it got on to the National Wire Service, and it actually, back then, Walter Cronkite would pick up stories, and he picked up this one, and he mentioned me on the news that evening as a little precursor to events of the day, and I continued with my trip, and when I would got into Kansas, people would wave at me and say, "Hi, Tim, how are you?" And I'd wonder, "Now, who in the heck do I know in Kansas?" And it wasn't until I got home that I told my mother. I said, "I'm sorry I wasn't able to call you every day." And she said, "That's okay. Cronkite mentioned it on the news every night."
Well, you were almost like the first car across the continent.
Something like that. The trip home was eventful. as I say, the temperature dropped a little before I got home, and I had called home, and a friend of mine decided he'd want to ride back. So he got a ticket to Lafayette, Indiana, and the night bus ticket out there, and was going to meet me at Lafayette. Well, that night I was in a little motel in a town in Illinois, and the temperature dropped from about 60 degrees to about 2 above zero. Now, this wouldn't matter nowadays, but if you're trying to start a Model T in the winter, it's a challenge. I had the rear wheel jacked up, and I had it thrown into high gear, and I was out front cranking this thing, and I could not get it started. And there was a fellow there with a tractor trailer rig, and he said, "Kid," he said, "you got a piece of rope?" Well, you always have a piece of rope with a Model T, either to pull yourself out or to wrap around the rear wheels to get yourself out of a mud hole. And I tied it around the front axle of the Model T, and he tied it to the back of the truck. And he said, now, when you get started, he says, blow your horn. Well, he pulled me out of that motel parking lot, and I'll bet he didn't pull me 50 feet before the Model T started up. So I blew that bulb horn, and, of course, he didn't hear it, and he started down the road. And as I say, my average speed was about 30, and we were doing about 40. And I'm blowing the heck out of that horn, and I'm sure the people coming from the other direction thought I was trying to pass him.
And I can envision the fact that if you had it in neutral and he started to stop kind of suddenly.
That was fun.
That was another thing, too, your braking ability.
Oh, good heavens.
Was it a happy ending?
It was. We got stopped. I got into Lafayette and picked my buddy up at the bus station, and he was dressed for a little warmer weather than we'd had. And we stopped at an Army-Navy store and decided we needed something a little warmer. So they had these rubber suits that looked like the Gorton fishermen would wear. And we bought those. Those were complete with the hats, too. We pulled up the floorboards in the front so we'd get a little warm air when it blew up underneath the car from the engine. And I took the canvas that I'd cover the car with, and we put it over our laps. We bought 3 pairs of insulated underwear, and that was the old type with the trap door in the back. So, and some insulated gloves, and we took off down the road, and the fella that wasn't driving was the fella responsible for trying to put the floorboards back in before a semi would pass us from the other way and suck all the hot air out of from underneath the tarp.
Well, you were very creative, but this was instinctive. You did this, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. It was a challenge, to say the least.
Well, you know, this was everyday type of procedures for people that drove cars back then. I mean, you picture a snowstorm now, and there's 4, 5, 6 inches of snow on the ground. Nothing really major. But, you know, they had to shovel everything by hand within the city. Everything was, unless they had a little plow on a horse and, pushing the snow out of the way. But, you know, most of the cars that were popular were open cars, because a lot of the limousines and closed cars, even though they did have them, they started making them early, like 1903, 4, 5, to the high-end automakers. They look like carriages, but the majority of cars made were roadsters and phaetons and touring cars, which are open cars, as you know. And when you're on the East Coast here and it gets cold, there's snow in that car, and they didn't have garages like we have now, and heaters, and people take that for granted. We can go into heater accessories. I don't know if you have one on your Model T or not, but, most people were asphyxiated by the time they got to where they had. The people in the back seat were dead.
Yeah.
Because they used to, as you know, the heaters were run off right out of the muffler.
Sure.
And they would run that hot air up into the back seat, and it basically was the fumes from the mufflers. So it was not too good. Of course, they did have other ones like charcoal heaters, but then the cars would start on fire and everything else. But there's always a conflagration, so to speak.
I used to use a warmed-up soapstone and wrap it up in the blanket and use it for a foot warmer. I drive back and forth from Huntington to Wellington in the touring car, and I did that for a winter or two before I had the Model A. And when you got to Wellington, you had to drain the radiator right away. And generally, if you were smart, you drained the oil too. And I used to have a enclosed bucket, and I'd take the radiator, the alcohol and radiator and the oil in the crankcase, and take it in the shop with me so it would be warm and I could pour it in the car to get it started in the winter to get home. That's what made the Model A look so good. I didn't have to do that anymore.
Yeah, now, how often, I mean, if you drove your cars a lot, like a Model T, it was always recommended in the service manuals to do a valve job every 500 miles or something like that. Was it a necessity to do that since the gasoline, obviously, we had more higher octane back in the 60s and 70s than we did back in the days when they were new?
Well, there was a lot of...
And a lot less lead in it, too.
Well, when the Model T was developed, there was no lead in it. And I think octane was whatever somebody thought it ought to be. And I always thought the octane of some of the gas back then had the power of kumquat juice. It was just all over the place. And so was oil. With what we have for oil and gas today, far superior to what they had at that time. Used to be you ground your valves every 2,000 or 3,000 miles, and gosh, I haven't ground the valves in my Model T in 40 years, and it runs pretty good. The other thing about leaded gas and unleaded gas is that I've never found it be any different in a Model T, and I've never burned a valve.
Hmm. Yeah, I know the octane, though, I know back, I think, in the 20s, anyway, was about, it was in the 50s or 60s range. And, you know, obviously that's why they had to do a lot of valve grinds, because it was always so low, and it was very, everything carboned up quite quickly. Nothing burned hot as such, you know.
Oh, gosh, no, you could burn alcohol in a Model T. You burn kerosene in it if you got it hot enough.
Right.
And I've done that, and that's one hard start and a smoky ride.
Well, anyway, you're listening to The Auto Era, and Tim Simonson is our guest this week. I'm Bernie Goliath, your host. And this is WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College, and Community Radio. I promised you another song. We'll get into this Gasoline Gus. Let's just see if this is another one of those old tunes that on Edison records, as I would call them, records or cylinders. And let's see if it sounds like a cat that's, that's in a distress call or not. But I think we'll get back with Tim after we play this song for you. Here we go.
Did you ever hear the story? Did you ever hear the yarn about what? About Gasoline Gus. He saved up a dollar, then he borrowed 20 cents.
Then what?
For the Disney bus. His coffee mill was made of tin, but tin was made to pack things in. He hung a sign and it read thus: this is Gasoline Gus and his hit name Buzz.
Forget.
according to Hoyle, he's not back yet.
Gus, gasoline, and it is me, Buzz.
Do you want to hear the finish? Do you want to hear the end?
About what?
About gasoline, Gus. He bumped into old Satan and he got old Satan.
Well, I just wanted to give you a little sampling of that because we only have a few more minutes, and you know I always fade out with the Beatles, "Come Drive My Car." But you know, we were talking about the clocks in cars. You know, we're looking at, you know, we're looking at time here. Now we got 5 minutes left of the show. But my question to Tim was, you know, cars started getting clocks as accessories, I think, as early, depending on the model. Which is an excellent question, historical question. But since Tim is a clockmaker and a clock repair expert, Tim, could you give us a little insight here in the next minute or so about maybe like Waltham clock?
Somehow
the cars started putting various clocks within their instrument panels?
Sure.
A little history.
Waltham started manufacture of automobile clocks quite early. The earliest I know of is about around 1914, 1915, on bigger cars such as old Buick, Cadillac, Oldsmobile. Sometimes Waltham would sell these in a number and actually place the logo of the automobile company on the dial of the clock. And in fact, those are probably the most desirable to find. But actually, a Waltham automobile clock was as much a watch as it was a clock. Very finely made, generally a 7 to 11 joule. Movement, and when you consider the type of bump and jolt that those type of clocks got, it's really amazing that they lasted as well as they did. Also, Finney Walker was another maker that produced clocks at the time, and even Ingersoll, the Dollar Pocket Watch Company, got into it. Generally, those for little accessory clocks for, cars like the Model A and the Model T and the Chevy at the time, for somebody that just had to have a timepiece in their car.